Blog Talk Radio.
Cubic miles of ice annually, 2003 to 2010. Traditionally, estimates of Earth ice caps and glaciers have been made using ground-based measurements from relatively few glaciers to infer that all of the unmonitored glaciers around the world were doing, he said. Only a few hundred of the roughly 200,000 glaciers worldwide have been monitored for a decade or more. The strength of GRACE is that it seems it sees everything in the system. Even though we don't have the resolution to look at individual glaciers, GRACE has proven to be an exceptional tool. The total does not count the mass from individual glaciers and ice caps from infringement of Greenland and Arctic ice sheets, roughly an additional 80 billion tons. And there's more to this article, but it's just interesting to note that it's not not what you think, folks, you know? And anyway, that I think that's kind of crazy. But anyway, I wanted to mention tonight. I wanted to do a series of articles on China. One on their education and one on a few other things that are going on there. It's not the wonderful world that you think it is. But one of the things I wanted to talk about tonight was this. Something that's not covered at all in the news. And we've talked about it last night, a couple of other nights last week, I believe. But the protests in Mexico are not being promoted. They're being totally ignored by the mass media, and the elections have been rigged. And I wanted to go to that tonight.
Can election results be trusted in a country notorious for election fraud? Thousands of people in Mexico are saying no and took to the streets over the weekend to protest the results of last week's election, where the reigning pre-party candidate Peña Nieto won 38.2% of the vote. Leftist presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador got 31.5% of the vote. The protesters are alleging that the pre-party won by buying the votes, and Obrador is planning on formally challenging the outcome of the election. So is there any evidence of voter fraud? And what will another term of pre mean for Mexico? To explore those questions and more, I'm joined by investigative journalist Andrew Kennett. Hey, Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So you're on the ground there. Tell us what you've seen from a journalistic standpoint of what's happening right there and right now and over the weekend.
Well, basically, since the pre-count election results were announced just last Monday, there's been an extraordinary amount of opposition and social ferment here in Mexico throughout the country, especially where Andrés Manuel López Obrador's support is strongest in Mexico City. There was a spontaneous protest right at the Federal Institute of Electoral offices, right, when announcements were being made about a recount being done. And then there was a massive protest on Saturday that was really done actually throughout the country and all the public plazas in the country, but was shown in its strongest and biggest, example of opposition right in the nation's capital's main plaza. What happened actually after that was there was a spontaneous protest that erupted right outside of a wedding of a major Televisa personality whose name was Eugenio Derbez. And actually, ironically, Derbez was a supporter of the movement, but nonetheless, the protesters targeted the wedding as a kind of a symbol of Televisa, which is really the second target of all the opposition and the protesters. It's not just Enrique Peña Nieto, who they're opposing, but it's also the alliance that was revealed, actually, by investigative reports in The Guardian, between the president-elect and Televisa in terms of contracts and deals, some airtime bought, some basically negotiated, dating all the way back to 2005, and with some deals, as we revealed through documents that were unearthed again by The Guardian, the London Space Daily, as recently as 2009. So Televisa controls about two-thirds of the country's free-to-air channels and has really been the darling of the president-elect. And like I said, but this new generation that's connected to Twitter, to Facebook, to each other through text messaging and other digital apparatus, they're really, really hit, so to speak, and actually are leading the protests against, again, not only the president-elect, but also Televisa itself.
So, Andrew, you're saying that it wasn't only perhaps some election fraud going on, but it was just the media monopolization and kind of putting him up on a pedestal and controlling the message.
Yeah, well, that's... that's definitely part of the equation, but I don't want to eliminate the other half.
No, yeah, go into that. I was just going
to... The protesters are just as angry and just as in opposition to the various vote-buying schemes that were arranged. The most prominent of which was really with the grocery chain called Soriana. And actually, one of the few papers to cover this a little bit more critically here in Mexico City showed a picture of the president-elect, ironically, with a T-shirt of Soriana standing in front of the supermarket, you know, holding his thumbs up. And really what was done there was that there were, basically voters organized and given prepaid Soriana kind of gift-buying grocery cards anywhere from 100 to 1,000 pesos, both before, during, and after the election. The biggest supporters of the opposition campaigns, have been really rallying around that as being the focal point of the vote-buying scheme, and have said that at least 3 million votes were pretty much, contested and bought or coerced through those specific means. But there are other vote-buying schemes as well, or coercion schemes as well, including through the nation's leading teachers union, which also compelled or coerced many of its members to vote for Peña Nieto, too. All varying schemes of illegalities that, fly in the face of electoral law here in Mexico, to the point where Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is challenging the results of the election, is now bringing his case to the Electoral Tribunal. And they have until September 6th to decide who will be the official winner, because as of now, there still really is not an official winner, thanks to all the allegations and all the controversy that's swirling down here.
Andrew, the election tribunal that's supposed to determine the outcome of the election, is there any sort of collusion going on between the reigning Prete party already and this tribunal?
Right. Well, there's no known instances of collusion, and not direct ones at least, but what we do know historically in that the last five elections, three of them, 60% of them have been hotly disputed, is that the Electoral Tribunal has never returned a decision by ESE, the official institute, the official federal institute that tabulates the votes. So there hasn't been any kind of precedent, despite really hotly contested elections, even one that was even closer, and more hotly contested in 2006, of the Electoral Tribunal overturning the results. But nonetheless, this was being tried for now, because the last time around that the election was contested by, again, the same opposition candidate, there was 2 months of protests and a lot of direct action. And, of course, the media turned against, the candidate as a result of that and really lambasted him throughout the airwaves and even in the newspapers as well for holding those protests right in the middle of the nation's capital. He literally grinded the nation's capital to a halt in doing that. So this time around, it seems he's taken a more kind of institutional electoral strategy. Again, historically, it really remains to be seen if that's going to work at all. And I don't think a lot of supporters are holding their breath for that to happen. So in spite of the official, campaign not calling for protests and not being a part of it, the protests continue to wage on spontaneously and with quite a lot of energy and fervent, almost on a daily basis in the nation's capital and beyond.
Yeah, it's hard to forget what happened last time, where so many did take over the capital. That was truly a momentous time in history. Andrew, I wanted to get your take on, the I Am 132 movement, Yo Soy
right.
Santo 32. What is,
right.
As you said, what we saw last week when it was more spontaneous, they have not really claimed that they started that. Are you seeing the two opposition movements kind of combining, or is it just totally organic at this point of what's going on?
I would say it's very organic what's going on at this point, because there were some skirmishes, actually, and some reports of police skirmishes in front of the ISE and between protesters. And some of the organizers, again, from one of the more elite private universities called the Iberoamericana, backed off a little bit from that, and especially from another even more private and more elite university called ETAM, backed off a little bit from sponsoring or calling for protests. But it really didn't matter, because the bulk of the student protesters and of the movement really still just showed up on the streets. These things are organized very organically through the Internet, through social media, and whether or not the leading organizers at all the different schools are behind it or not, the protests just continue to happen. And like I said, in a very spontaneous manner, the energy, I was, literally on the scene in a very trendy kind of street in the middle of Mexico City in front of what's called Calle Regina and the church there. And the energy, there were just 24 protesters there at first, but literally everybody from the Zocalo kind of poured into the church area, which was about 10 blocks away, in a spontaneous manner. And the energy and the fervent in the opposition there was just tremendous. You had little kids kind of repeating what the protesters were saying, which was fire at Televisa, you know, get the heck out of here, Televisa. And it really does seem, I would say, you know, that kind of symbolizes to me that there's a turning point here where the newer, younger generation is really learning that, you know, mainstream media is just not the way to go for reliable sources of information. And they're just turning to alternative sources in ways that, in unprecedented ways and ways that are organized and really fueling the protest movement down here.
It does seem like that is happening worldwide, where there's a generational gap of the younger generation kind of awakening to the whole establishment system from the top down. Andrew, to get your take on just what will it mean for Mexico if the outcome is indeed upheld and Peña Nieto, you know, continues to reign and just goes on and on. I mean, talk about how long they've been instated and what this will mean for them to continue to rule the country.
Well, wow. I mean, the PRI was in power for 71 years until 2000, and many critics argue that the PAN system, more, you know, the party that took over and won the last two presidencies, is just a more conservative version of that. So you add up that, and that's 90 years of two, you know, very right-wing conservative parties ruling over Mexico with a stranglehold kind of grip, you know, whether it's been through vote-buying schemes or really fueling, as was the case with the PAN, a very, very, you know, violent war that's claimed over 50,000 civilian deaths just since the Calderon administration came to office. So, you know, the majority of the country, the very clear, you know, almost super majority of the country voted against Peña Nieto. You know, for better or for worse, there is no runoff scheme here in Mexico. So with just, you know, a bit over 30% of the electorate voting for him, I mean, that's even lower percentages than I think George Bush won in either election. You know, Peña Nieto is coming to power. So the whole country is really kind of gripping itself, very tense, very, very nervous about a return to power by the PRI. You know, one of the most notorious acts that Peña Nieto did in his short-lived political career as governor of the state of Mexico was he authorized a very, very violent repression of a largely peaceful farmers movement in a town called Atenco that was literally fighting for its life, trying to preserve land that was given to them through land reforms dating back to the Mexican Revolution that was being threatened by the construction of a new airport to service Mexico City. The movement actually ultimately won out in stopping the construction of the airport, but it didn't win out in terms of suffering very violent repression. Over 100 women were, you know, made rape allegations officially, over two dozen that were arrested and brought to jail. And dozens of other protesters reported beatings that, really resulted in the condemnation from Amnesty International and many other international human rights groups for the treatment that Peña Nieto dealt out. And that's just, you know, one incident. So given the PRI's history and then the history of Peña Nieto itself, the country is pretty scared, really, what this might mean in terms of a return to repression and much less a continuance, because it was recently announced by the Peña Nieto campaign, a continuance of the same way that the drug war has been fought since Calderon came to office. That was one of the first announcements that Peña Nieto made as president-elect, was that he would continue the national security strategy as has been executed since Calderon took the office. So
and as we've seen, a lot of violence rages on in Mexico still. It's just erupted. I used to live in San Diego, and it's really intense over there. And it will be very interesting to see how this plays out. Thanks so much for giving us your take, Andrew. I was investigative journalist Andrew Kenneth.
Thanks for coming on.
Okay. That
they're having big troubles down there in Mexico, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're just not...
Not a word said about it on the mainstream media.
No. No, you just don't get it. But anyway, that's just the way it is. So the other thing I wanted to talk about tonight, it was fascism in America.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that's happening. You know, but I wanted to read the warning signs, and I wanted to read this article because I thought it was pretty good.
And you guys see what you think.
Weimar America, four major ways we're following in Germany's fascist footsteps.
What happens when a nation that was
just
once...
Read the early
warning
signs.
Yeah, well, I
will. No, read them now first, and then we go to that.
That's going to be incorporated in the
I think it's important to read them. All right. Early warning signs of fascism. Powerful and continuing nationalism. Identification of enemies, scapegoats as a unifying cause. Al-Qaeda.
You missed disdain for human rights.
Yeah. Supremacy of the military.
Rampant sexism.
Controlled mass media.
Obsession with national security. Got that.
Religion and government are intertwined.
Corporate power is protected.
Labor power is suppressed.
Disdain for intellectuals and the arts.
Obsession with crime and punishment.
rampant cronyism and corruption.
And fraudulent election.
Boy, we could tick all those, couldn't
yeah.
we? Let's go to the main
yeah,
article.
And I mean, it's quite frightening when you really think about what's going on. We've seen this for so long.
And this is from Alternet?
Yeah.
What
happens when a nation that was once an economic powerhouse turns its back on democracy and on its middle class? As wealthy right-wingers wage austerity campaigns and enable extremist politics.
It may sound like America in 2012, but it was also Germany in 1932. Most Americans have never heard of the Weimar Republic, Germany's democratic interlude between World War I and World War II. Those who have usually see it as a prologue to the horrors of Nazi Germany, an unstable transition between imperialism and fascism. In this view, Hitler's rise to power is treated as an inevitable outcome of the Great Depression, rather than the result of a decision by right-wing politicians to make him chancellor in early 1933. Historians reject technological approaches to studying the past. No outcome is inevitable, even if some are more likely than others. Rather than looking for predictable outcomes, we ought to be looking to the past to understand how systems operate, especially liberal capitalist democracies. In that sense, Weimar Germany holds many useful lessons for contemporary Americans. In particular, there are four major points of similarity between Weimar Germany and Weimar America worth examining. The first one is austerity. Today's German leaders preach the virtues of austerity. They justify their opposition to the inflationary growth-creating policies that Europe desperately needs by pointing to the hyperinflation that occurred in 1923 and became one of the most enduring memories of the Weimar Republic. Yet the austerity policies enacted after the onset of the Depression produced the worst of Germany's economic crises, while also destabilizing the country's politics. Cuts to wages, benefits, and public programs dramatically worsened unemployment, hunger, and suffering. So far, austerity in America has largely taken place at the state and local levels. However, the federal government is now working on undemocratic national austerity plans in the form of so-called trigger cuts, slated to take effect at the end of 2012. In addition, there's the bold Simpson austerity plan to slash Medicare and Social Security benefits, along with a host of other public programs, and the Ryan budget, a blueprint for widespread federal austerity should the Republicans win control of the Congress and the White House in November.
Attacks on democracy. Austerity was deeply unpopular with the German public. The Reichstag, Germany's legislature, initially rejected austerity measures in 1930. As a result, right-wing Chancellor Heinrich Brüning implemented his austerity measures by using a provision in the Weimar Constitution enabling him to rule by decree. More notoriously, Hitler was selected as Chancellor despite his party never having won an election, and the ultimate slap at democracy. Both these events took place amid the larger backdrop of anti-democratic attitudes rampant in the Weimar era. Monarchists, fascists, and large businesses all resented the left-leaning politics of a newly democratic Germany and supported politicians and intellectuals who pledged to return control to a more authoritarian government. Democracy is far older in the United States today than it was in Germany during the early 1930s. But that doesn't mean that democracy is actually respected in the practice today. It only means that attacks on it can't be as overt as they were in Weimar Germany. For the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling to Republican voter ID laws to austerity proposals that bypass the normal legislative processes, remembering the Super Commission, American democracy is under similar direct threats now.
Number three. Enabling of extremists. Well before Hitler was made chancellor in 1933, Leading conservatives and business leaders had concluded that their interests would be better served by something other than the democratic system established in 1919. During the 1920s, they actively supported parties that promoted anti-democratic ideologies from monarchism to authoritarianism. Nazis were just one of the many extremist groups that they supported during the Weimar era. In fact, initially, many on the German right had attempted to exclude the Nazis from their efforts, and as Chancellor, Brüning had tried to marginalize the Nazi Party. However, his successor, the right-wing Franz von Papen, believed he could control Hitler and needed the support of the Nazi members of the Reichstag. Conservative German leaders ultimately decided their hunger for power was more important than keeping extremists at bay, and their support finally gave the Nazi Party control of the country.
Basically, that's what's happening today with the GOP.
With the conservatives.
Yeah, conservatives are insane. Tea Party activists aren't Nazis, but with roots in the 20th century radical right, the Tea Party attack on the public sector, labor unions, on democratic practices, on people who aren't white, mark them as the extremist wing of the American politics. And they bear many of the hallmarks that characterize fascist movements around the world. In recent years, Republican leaders have been enabling these extremists in a successful bid to reclaim political power lost to Democrats in 2006 and 2008. We don't yet know where this enabling is going to lead the country, but it's hard to imagine it will be anywhere good.
Number four, right wing and corporate dominance. One of the most prominent German media moguls in the 1920s was Alfred Hugenberg, owner of 53 newspapers that reached over a majority of German readers. The chairman of the right-wing German National People's Party, Hugenberg, promoted Adolf Hitler by providing favorable coverage of him from the mid-1920s onward. Major German corporations such as Krupp, IG Farben, and others spent money in the 1920s and early 1930s in support of the rise of the right-wing political parties. Excuse me.
Including the Nazis. As part of his strategy to undermine democracy and labor unions, even if Hitler had never taken power, that strategy that already achieved significant returns on their substantial investment. Here in the United States, one only needs to look at Charles and David Koch, Fox News, and other right-wing funders and their media outlets to see the analogy. By funding right-wing politicians who promote austerity, undermine democracy, and support extremism, they are active agents in the creation of a Weimar America.
None of this means that the United States is about to fall victim to a fascist coup d'etat as Germany did in 1933. Remember that no outcome in this event is inevitable. Nor would it be accurate to say that the United States is repeating the exact same events and taking the same course as Germany did during the 1930s because of many other important details are different. For example, Germany was a nation saddled with huge debt and lacking the global political power it needed to reverse its situation. But even with today's high unemployment rates, the United States remains the globe's largest economy and therefore doesn't face the same fiscal constraints Weimar Germany faced. In fact, a better current analogy may be Greece, which is in far more similar predicament now. Yet the underlying similarities ought to be troubling and are enough to give us pause. The combination of austerity and well-funded right-wing political movements hostile to democracy destroyed Weimar Germany. And Spain and Italy both experienced a similar situation in their slide into authoritarianism in the 1930s. In those cases, and in ours, as people saw their own financial position weaken, and as the democratic rights were increasingly limited in favor of giving more power to the large corporations, the future of a democratic society with a strong middle class was increasingly jeopardized. Fascism is what happens when right-wing plutocrats weaken the middle class and then convince it to turn its back on democracy. Will Weimar America face the same disastrous fate Weimar Germany did? On our current path, democracy and shared prosperity are both in serious trouble. We owe it to ourselves, to our children, and to our world to look to the lessons of history find a way to change course and get to work building something better.
It's scary, folks.
And that was by Robert Cruikshank.
Ultimate.
He did a good job on that article.
Yeah. But it pretty frightening, though, overall, I think. I kind of like this when I read this. Blair faces protest against his return. British anti-war protesters are to once more disrupt former Prime Minister Tony Blair's plan to come back to domestic politics with a major demonstration. Blair is to appear, it'd be like Bush coming back to politics, you know. Nobody wants to see that son of a bitch back. That's the same with Blair.
I thought he was pretty much disgraced, but these people have no...
Well, they get no shame.
No, none at all.
Shame whatsoever. Domestic... Five years of waiting for the storm of illegal intervention in Iraq to pass. Blair had to cancel an address to Labour Party activists in Lambeth, South London, on Monday. At their last moment, when anti-war protesters found out about the venue of his speech and warned that he will face a large demonstration if he goes on with his plans. I'm surprised they haven't picked him up for war crimes.
Yeah.
Anti-war activists have now planned another rally against Blair outside Arsenal Stadium in London, where the dinner is planned to be held. Tony Blair is on the comeback trail to rehabilitate his political career. Help give him the welcome he deserves when he speaks at the Arsenal Stadium on Wednesday, July 11th. That's tomorrow. War criminals are not welcome here or anywhere except for the International Criminal Court facing war crime charges. The Stop the War Coalition has organized the protest. The group also called an Arsenal football club to uninvited Blair from the event. Stop the War convener Lindsay German said Blair is globally discredited for his war crimes in Iraq, which eventually led to his forced resignation in September 2006. Blair has confessed that he would like to be prime minister again. Conveniently, he forgets that he was forced out of office 3 years before he wanted to go, German said. The problem for Blair is that the one issue that he wants to forget, Iraq, is the one issue that everyone remembers. It is the decision which will dog him for the rest of his life. Yeah. And, it's just amazing, the egos of these morons, that they think they can, they think they can screw the whole world and then come back and get a political
and
life.
And screw them again.
Yeah. You know, it's like, I don't know. I'm glad the Britons are pissed off enough at it,
Some.
Not all, unfortunately, not all. But, a lot of them are just rah-rah-rah, and, they don't even know what the hell they're doing. The other thing that it's like Americans, huh? I wanted to go to these Russian articles, Chinese articles tonight because, because I thought they were so extremely good, and I will get them in 1 second.
Just have a little patience.
Yeah, I just got to move along here to get them, but, couple of interesting aspects about Chinese education as opposed to American education.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out it's not that great, okay? And I wanted to read this article about it. Here.
It's coming.
Hopefully
it'll come up.
It's in print there. Yeah, it's coming.
I don't see it.
Sometimes these things take so long coming.
There it is.
Okay. Says the difference between Chinese and American education.
A recent internet post contrasting Chinese and American approaches to educating youngsters was hotly discussed and widely forwarded online, particularly by Chinese mothers who were eager to seek the best education for their children. The article post titled "Surprisingly, My Son Reads Such an Education in America" described the school life of a 9-year-old Chinese boy who moved from China to the United States. It was soon reposted nearly 5,000 times on Xinyi Weibo, Chinese version of Twitter. In China, the His bag had been full of heavy books from first grade. From grade 1 to grade 4, we changed school bags 3 times. The next one was always bigger than the previous. We assumed the amounts of knowledge given to him was also growing, confessed the mother, who at the beginning was rather confused about the free-spirited American teaching style. Unlike in Western countries, students in China do not have the freedom to choose what they want to learn. Chinese schools uniformly use standardized textbooks composed and published by the regime. From grade 1, students receive 1 textbook for each subject and have to carry the ones they need to school for class every day. But when she asked what was the best thing about going to the school in the U.S., her son answered, freedom. His words hit me like a bang in the head, the mother wrote. In China, individual research is really used at education levels before college, and students are usually given standardized answers to exercises. One day, her son brought back books from the library to work on a project which he called The Past and Future of China. She thought to herself, such a bold topic. Would a PhD candidate even dare to work on it? Soon the results took her by surprise. I was stunned upon seeing his work. He separated the materials he gathered into sections and chapters and attached a bibliography in the end. This was the writing style I learned during grad school, and at that time I was 30 years old, said she in the post. Another major difference was history class. When I saw my son browsing through books about the world wars with joy, I couldn't help but thinking about how boring it was for me to memorize the time and detail of historic events. Even when the conclusions were obviously pedantic and wrong, I had no choice but to memorize it. Materials in history classes in China are often strongly propagandistic and fabricated for political reasons. A Chinese elementary textbook available online shows the first long reading exercises for first graders. It is a 200-character passage about a prominent communist figure planting a tree. Grandpa Zheng Jiaoping attracted the eyes of many. He held a shovel in his hands and his forehead full of sweat, but still he would not want to take a break, the text said. In contrast, American teachers encourage students to find answers to history themselves, the mother wrote. Teachers are expressing the idea of humanism through questions, and they help them to pay attention to the fate of human beings. They teach the kids the ways to tackle big questions. There are no standard answers to these questions, and some of them require someone to use his or her whole life to search for the answers. I always think about the way elementary students work in China. They sit with their backs straight, carry heavy books, spend hours on homework, and do the best to pass the rigid exam, she wrote. It gives us a huge sense of pressure and oppression.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I just had just another look at how things are going. But China is going down. I thought that was an interesting article, too.
Well, Africa is on the rise.
Africa's on the rise now, yeah. So China's
boom and bust.
Boom and bust.
Now Africa.
Yeah. There is something perversely satisfying in watching humans screw up on a massive scale, especially if you've seen it coming for years. China's time has come. They're going down. Forbes News. China's time is coming. They're going down. Late last week, there was a surprise interest rate cut to spur borrowing and growth. And then today, we found out that China's import growth misses estimates for June. And China's imports rose less than anticipated in June, pushing the trade surplus to a 3-year high and adding pressures on the government to support demand as the global economy slows. Inbound shipments increased 6.3% from an earlier year, Customs Bureau said in a statement today in Beijing, compared with 11% median estimate in a Bloomberg News survey of 32 economists. Export growth slowed to 11.3%, and the trade surplus rose to 31.7%. So I don't know what that really means there. I don't see how that's going down.
Do they have more?
Growth slowed to 11.3, but the trade surplus rose to 31.0. Trade surplus. It is hard to believe official growth numbers emanating from China, but it can be believed. But if we can believe their custom data, oil imports have slowed dramatically. Beijing is China in July 10th. From Reuters, China's crude imports plunged in June to their lowest daily rate since December, coming off a record high in May. Custom data showed as refiners cut imports and the slowing oil demand in the world's second largest oil consumer and crude buyer. I wonder the way that is. Yeah, it's probably because they're not getting the kind of work that they were getting. The high crude imports in May didn't match the actual demand for refinery results and high inventories. Refineries have to cut imports from June, said Beijing. Commercially, refiners have no motivation to import more crude as they are cutting crude runs. And strategically, we have not seen any new state storage put into operation recently, so I don't think crude imports will rebound quickly. And crude imports in June were 5.29 million barrels per day, up 10.3% from a year earlier. June imports were 12% or around 710 barrels lower than the recorded 6.3 billion in May. So for some reason they're going down in May. Could this mean China's real economy is weaker than we thought? I don't know. Does a bear shit in the woods? Is the Pope Catholic? Fortune, Gordon Chang has been predicting China's crash for over a decade now, so he's particularly pleased to see the predictions finally borne out. The Daily Ticker posted the video below of China's economy. So, you know, it just seems that it's possible that China has finally come to an end of its boom, you know. And, you know, we'll see. I think this election is going to be a big thing. You know, what happens in our election, mm-hmm. all right,
it's
going to make a big difference. Yeah, I really do think so. Maybe not in the sense that it, I don't know. If Obama maintains his place, all right, things will kind of be the same as they were. But if Romney gets in, I'm kind of scared that things could get much worse with Romney, because he's a nightmare. That's a nightmare. That kind of like McCain was a nightmare, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, I mean, what do we know? We just right. Hey, we're just radio talk show hosts. That's all we know. But I oh man, I got signed out here. Sorry, folks. Yeah, these things are wicked to us. I don't know why the internet is so difficult to travel through sometimes.
Let's go.
Huh? Let's go. That's only on your right there. Press go. But I just wanted to say that with the advent of everything is seeming to get weirder and weirder and weirder. We're trying to hold our own here.
Yep.
Yeah. And
we're doing our best.
We're doing our best to do it. And I don't know how that's handy. But it's just that there's no news. All the news is so censored, it's frightening. And unless you go through some of these, you know, hurdles, try to find new news, like we do, it's just ain't there, you know. And that's why I'm grateful that we have a growing audience every week.
And lots of times people send us stuff, which is really nice, and we appreciate
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we might have missed it, and it's good to get it.
Sure. And but I find a lot of stuff recently is a lot of my sources are not drying up, but they're getting redundant,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's not good. That, what that means is they're drying up of their sources too. Anyway, hang on 1 second here.
Do you have another article on?
Yeah, there's another. Yeah, I did. I just wanted to. Down here. try again.
One more time, folks. What article are you looking for? What is this article?
There's another article here on China that I thought was interesting. So, pull it up in a second here.
Well, that's the woman just here.
No, hang on.
I don't know. That was from the computer.
Huh. Sounded like a human.
I know.
No, that's weird. The Chinese 30% fraud. I thought this was kind of interesting. Tax evasion in China exceeds 1 trillion won. That's what I wanted to do. I thought that was really, you know, I mean, when I talk about tax evasion,
Leo's sister just came back from China. It costs $10,000 if you live in Shanghai to register your car.
Yeah.
So they must be making some pretty good money over there.
And their cars are the same price as our cars. And yeah. They're buying American cars.
That's the favorite car there.
The only difference is that their oil is a lot cheaper and their gas is cheaper.
The Chinese 30% fraud. A large number of Chinese exporters and trading companies are reportedly engaged in mass fraud of international buyers and customers, which is gradually reaching the alarming level as infamous Nigerian fraud or Cameroon fraud in today's world. According to specific evidences, Chinese exporters demand 30% of the amount of the ordered goods in advance, either through TT or Western Union. This has already spread amongst 99% of the Chinese suppliers as virus. While the major segment of the Chinese suppliers declined to accept a letter of credit for export, hundreds of international traders and business houses are becoming victims of such Chinese 30% fraud, which in most cases ignored by the Chinese authorities, similarly as those in Nigeria, Cameroon, in some of the ill-reputed African countries. Chinese government, which has achieved a remarkable progress in uplifting the country's economy to an enormous level just within the span of 20-plus years, are reluctant in combating such fraud rackets in their country for reasons unknown. Such activities of the fraudulent Chinese 30% fraud rackets are greatly dampening the image of the People's Republic of China as well as its government and law enforcement agencies.
Only in June, at last 50 cases, at least 50 cases of such fraud by the 30% fraud racket took place in various parts of China, including Shenzhen, Fujian, and Xingdai in Hebei province. In one of the many cases, a Chinese company named Electronic Technology Company Limited, 6F, Building 201 Shenkei International Park, I don't know what the hell it was, sold Chinese tablets, PCs, to a customer against the payment of a U.S. $2,850. The company thought, though promised to ship the consignment within 3 days of receiving the payment, after almost 1 week of receiving the full payment into its Chinese bank account, Pingfei Electronic Technology Company Limited provided a fake tracking number of DHL only on July 21st, stating that the goods were already shipped. After the buyer discovered the tracking number to be a fake, the Chinese company quickly made up another story stating it had problems with shipping the tablet PCs through DHL and provided another false tracking number to the customer, asking them to track the shipment on intel.183.com/whatever. Then the second tracking number was also a fraud to be false. The Chinese company's sales manager, Selena, turned off her mobile number and stopped communicating with the buyer. Seeing no other alternatives, the buyer reported the matter with the Chinese authorities. Until filing of this report, no action had been initiated against the fraud racket of the authorities. And that's probably because they're getting kickbacks.
Yeah.
You know, they're allowing it, and China authorities are getting kickbacks. In another incident, a Chinese company named Xingtai Hengemen Trading Company signed an agreement with a buyer for supplying 15 tons of edible oil. All right. Accordingly, the Chinese company received U.S. $8,000 as advance payment and was supposed to receive the remaining amount immediately before the shipment. The payment of $8,000 was made in June 3rd, 2012. But right after receiving the advance payment, the Chinese company informed the buyer that it has problems in arranging a Shengjian certificate, okay, or quality approval of ministry, blah, 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 Republic of China. Under such circumstances, the buyer undertook that Frank Geo, as his names are nightmares, has fraudulently received the advance payment of U.S. $8,000, giving false promise of making shipment, and later on receiving the amount came up with his story of not being able to manage their Shengjian certificate. So anyway, the guy got screwed. Okay, and it goes on and on. And commenting on already traced fraud of Peng Fei in electronic technology as well as the Zhengtai Hengmen Trading Company, business leaders are suggesting that Chinese authorities need to initiate immediate and stern actions against these fraud gangs in order to save their reputation as genuine business communities. It says China is a disciplined nation, and it is not expected that hundreds of fraudsters will operate within its territories. That's bullshit because, I mean, all they do is counterfeit U.S. products over there.
Mm-hmm.
All right? All they do is they're all fraud, complete and utter fraud. And it's being allowed by that government, okay? And it's being allowed by the people that are running, that are importing and exporting. You know, that's the whole game. So, you know, I mean, it's about time, you know, we find out that China is nothing but a fraud, you know.
It's still from
everybody.
It's still everybody's ideas and just, you know.
Oh, here's another one. Alibaba and the Chinese thieves. Alien technology and thought control. Tax evasion in China exceeds 1 trillion won. 14 bodies found after mudslide in China's system. But Alibaba and the Chinese thieves. Want to check that one?
Mm-hmm.
Since we're on the corruption of the Chinese economy. Everyone must have heard
the name of the Arabian fairy tale titled Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. Now with the changes of time, the same Alibaba is back, an entire nation named Chinese, who are continuing to cheat people around the world while their activities are well protected and guarded by the rogue Chinese administrative system. China has already earned a huge bad name by counterfeiting most of the globally acclaimed international brands, including Toshiba, Sony, Panasonic, Apple, Asus, Intel, Kingston, Sands.
It goes on and on and on.
Yeah,
there's 100 of them already. Calvin Klein, Channelx, Sectera, and Nextera.
It also rumored that China was printing counterfeit American dollars, euros, and even Indian and Pakistani rupees on a regular basis and putting the same into circulation through its Netsin. Mafia is based in Hong Kong and Macau, as well as the mainland. In one word, Chinese are today's world known as forgers, counterfeiters, and fraudsters.
Well, Chinese thieves are continuing stealing money from hundreds and thousands of people around the world, almost 24/7. Okay, all the Chinese web portals, including Alibaba, are giving opportunity to these gangs and continuing their illegal activities simply because these Chinese thieves pay certain amounts of money to Alibaba as friendship fees every year. While many consider such membership fees as their bribes, it is well proven fact that Chinese politicians, big bosses of ruling Communist Party and its army and non-military administration are indulged in massive corruption and crime, while China is creating a new generation of thieves and criminals who might continue looting wealth of the international community for many decades from now. There is no law in China to stop these criminals. Rather, the state machinery and its corrupt system give patronization to such activities. In the eyes and philosophies of Chinese people, stealing money from people around the world is justified because those who are looted are class enemies of the communists. Imagine that. The entire Chinese population is totally rogue, and its people are such money mongers that any Chinese girl or female can be laid to bed for anyone by anyone who could simply offer them a lucrative amount of money. It's a commonly believed in China that every Chinese woman and girl are ready and selling their bodies if they get nice price, and nice is in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is a country with people either already involved in the prostitution or very much inclined in selling their bodies simply in exchange for some material benefit. Women in China, to date, do not enjoy any respectable position in society, and possibly Chinese women are the only species in today's world who are treated like mere animals by their male partners. With the inflow of huge cash within societies, with the growth in industrial sectors, the entire Chinese nation is running after money by hook or crook. Every woman in the nation are already offering their vagina and womb to anyone in exchange for money. Wow, that's pretty rough stuff. Though China has gained some status economically and social sense, this nation has become nothing but a huge brothel. Morality has gone into extinction from the Chinese society, especially from the women. According to a survey conducted by a Hong Kong-based organization, almost 90% of the Chinese girls sell their virginity to other men in exchange for money, while the birth rate of children without father has sharply increased and now crosses the percentage of 20%. Scamming.
We just have like a couple of minutes.
Sorry. Chinese people are brilliant in learning any evil trick. They learned the trick of counterfeiting foreign products and are labeled as champion violators of copyrights and patent rights. Now that same nation has become prominent in the world of scammers who are infamous for scamming and scams. According to the information available on the web, every month Chinese fraudsters steal more than $100 million from various people around the world. These Chinese scammers and fraudsters have entered most of their social and business sites, such as Amazon, eBay, Facebook, Twitter, Alibaba, and name a few. In all of these sites, Chinese devils are hunting foreigners to scam them and run away with their money. Economic analysts believe the frequency of fraud and cheating by the Chinese scammers are already crossing all past records, including those of Nigerian, Cameroon, and other African rackets.
Wow.
Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, and it just says, for years, the Chinese traders and exporters are following the ridiculous practice of asking the buyers of any product for placing 30 to 50% of the total cost in advance through money in Western unions and so on. We just covered that, but
yeah.
Most of the buyers of Chinese products are rather forced to place such advance payments simply as considering the price advantage. Most importantly, almost 90% of these Chinese scammers, cheaters, and frauds are legally legitimate companies, having licenses issued by the Chinese government with bank accounts at various banks in China. And according to information, only during June 2012, more than 5,000 complaints of such scam, cheating, and fraud by the Chinese companies were filed by various international buyers. And in most cases, these have been any action taken against the scammers. They name all of these different scam companies.
Yeah, so beware if you're going to buy any Chinese products that you could be in jeopardy.
You're going to be scammed, yeah.
You're going to be scammed. So why don't you just buy American and Nazi?
Just buy American. Support Americans.
And we're right up to the end of the hour, so it's really good to be with you.
And join me tomorrow.
And good night, folks.
And good night, everybody.
That's your music.
Yeah, there you go.